Mr. President, members of the Yunus family, especially Fuad and Nahad, and all the families who have memories today, members of the university, excellencies, ladies and gentlemen. Thank you, Malek, thank you, Omar, for your introduction. It's a great privilege not only to be in a series of lecturers in Nadia's name that have been speaking to you since 2005, but also to be the first speaker in this new campus, which is so impressing us all, certainly on my first visit. So congratulations, President, on that great achievement of opening this new intellectual city at the heart of the intellectual city of the Middle East. And it was a special privilege this afternoon to be part of the inauguration of Nadia's International Model United Nations Conference Room on this campus. These new constructions and these new initiatives are bringing us together to deal with a world that I want to talk to you about. On the 19th of August 2003, the blow that was struck at the Canal Hotel in Baghdad was doubly cruel. Not only did we lose, and for some people in this audience, that loss was extremely personal. Relatives, friends, and colleagues. But the United Nations lost its innocence, and Iraq lost the United Nations. Secretary General Kofi Annan paid the most marvelous tribute to Nadia when he gave the first memorial lecture in November 2005. And Bernard Kouchner and Mary Robinson, in their very different styles, delivered marvelous personal tributes to Nadia. I cannot and shall not compete with them. We all know that Nadia brought wisdom, high international ideals, and a wicked humour to a lot of places and a lot of people in need of those things. She also brought life to every room she was in, and she has not stopped doing that in our memories, even now, 5.5 years on tomorrow. On that day in August 2003, my wife and I were in our country cottage in Woodstock, New York, drawing breath after 5 stimulating and exhausting years at UN headquarters, and preparing for my assignment in the unpredictable circumstances of the Coalition Provisional Authority in Baghdad. I was beginning to plan how I would work with Sergio Vieira de Mello as UN representative in Iraq, even for the short period that we were going to be together in Baghdad. I was sure in my own mind that the United States on its own would not be able to accomplish the hard task of stabilizing post-Saddam Iraq. And I envisaged the United States, the United Nations, and the United Kingdom working in some kind of a triangular relationship to meet that task. This was an ambitious concept, given the certainty that the US would want to be in strong control. Sergio was already becoming frustrated that his experience in the business of post-conflict stabilization and reconstruction was being less than fully utilized. But I was as convinced as he was that the UN could bring a legitimacy to the international operation in Iraq without which the coalition's operation there would be deeply flawed. And I imagined that the two of us will be able to get the point across. Alas, in his wonderful upholding of the independence and the overarching quality of the United Nations, Sergio made a serious mistake. The CPA offered the UN team assistance in guarding the perimeter of the Canal Hotel, but Sergio was unwilling to go in that direction of dependence on the occupying power. He also underestimated the calculating viciousness of Al-Qaeda and its terrorism. The UN learnt the hard way that it is part of the real world of good and evil after all. The attack that same month on the Jordanian embassy in Baghdad and the assassination of Ayatollah Mohammed Bakr al-Hakim, Iraq's leading Shia cleric and a man of moderation and peace, achieved a triple strike of devastating effect. But it was the scene at the Canal Hotel, appearing on our primitive television set in Woodstock on the 19th of August, which stopped us in our personal tracks. The capacity of the coalition to do good in Iraq gravely deteriorated that month, although the coalition's American leadership never fully realized it. In talking to you this afternoon about the lessons from Iraq in this historic city and in the memory of one of Egypt's most engaging and globally minded daughters, I want to see whether we can benefit from our mistakes. I'd like to pose some questions about how the West and the Middle East can work more productively together to address the challenges which still confront this important region. In particular, I want to ask, first, what was justifiable and what was not about this further Western intrusion into Arab affairs? What went wrong and why? What does it tell us about our 21st century world? Can we learn lessons that will make a difference to the next crisis? The reasons for the invasion of Iraq in March 2003 were, for the United Kingdom, grounded in Saddam Hussein's contravention of successive UN resolutions and the threat which he posed to his neighbours and to the region as a whole. The United States appeared to have other reasons, but it is not my task this afternoon, unless you want to raise it in discussion, to explain or defend them. I will just say this, because people ask the question so often, that never in my direct experience or in anything that I heard was the invasion of Iraq anything to do with oil. We can talk about that, but that was not what it was about. The collection of UN resolutions since 1991 gave a clear, if thin, legal basis in that Saddam Hussein had never lived up to the ceasefire arrangements after the first Gulf War. Much more significant than that was that a convincing political legitimacy for the invasion and for the coalition's presence in Iraq thereafter was never sufficiently established. Washington believed that the attacks of 11 September 2001 provided an overwhelming natural justification for American national action in Afghanistan and Iraq thereafter. The British government was sympathetic to this approach, but not convinced that it provided a convincing justification on its own. They nevertheless decided to stay with the United States, underestimating the effect on UK domestic opinion of going to war on another state, even a close ally's rationale. The fundamental truth is that too small a proportion of the membership of the United Nations and of public opinion in all our countries, even eventually in the United States, believed that the action taken was appropriate to or proportionate to the threat which Iraq represented. The failure subsequently to discover any usable weapons of mass destruction in Iraq compounded this absence of support. The invasion itself was a masterpiece of American military planning and implementation. No country of Iraq's size can stand up to the full force of US military power. But there turned out to be a remarkable gap in Washington's forward thinking. The mission that was set, and therefore the deployment of people and resources to fulfill it, was for a limited objective: the removal of Saddam Hussein and his regime from power in Baghdad. General Tommy Franks, the CENTCOM commander, was never asked to plan for or lead, as he should have been, the stabilization and reordering of Iraq after the invasion. The early weeks and months of the civilian administration of Iraq after the 9th of April were chaotic, and the CPA's structures and operations were dysfunctional. In the absence of real security around Iraq, other forces saw the opportunity and exploited it. The UN's advice on reforming a country after conflict was ignored. The UK failed to ask hard enough questions of its ally. And the UK role, as I knew, as Ambassador Asquith knew as he followed me in Baghdad, was secondary, was limited, although we bore an equal responsibility in the UN for what happened in Iraq. And the US military were unprepared for the responsibilities, military, organizational, and moral, of occupation. Now, I'm going to draw your attention to a new book that's just been released, and it's interesting because of where it comes from. It's called Hard Lessons: The Iraq Reconstruction Experience, and it is written by the Special Inspectorate General for Iraq Reconstruction. For those of you who want to look it up, www.segir.mil. And it produces some hard conclusions on what happened in Iraq between 2003 and 2008. It says in a chapter summing up the lessons from Iraq, hard lessons: the CPA's reconstruction strategy was premised on a permissive environment, meaning one generally free from violence. But most of Iraq was racked by violence for most of the CPA's existence. Almost immediately after the invasion in Iraq, many in Iraq, from the CPA administrator and the commanding general of coalition forces to Iraqis in the ministries and on the streets, recognized that security was the most compelling issue confronting the country. Immediately after the invasion, they recognized that security was the most compelling issue. And later, with the increase in violence, planners confronted a political and economic landscape that was evolving faster than they could adapt to or understand. All the while, the magnitude of what needed to be done was overwhelming. The absence of a well-defined doctrine or an effectively coordinated strategy caused the CPA's approach to reconstruction to have a disjointed and ad hoc quality. Get the oil flowing. Stop the smugglers. Get the electricity up and running. Clean out the sewers. Rewrite the textbooks. Change the currency. Employ more Iraqis. Focus on the cities. Focus on agriculture. Focus on security. That is the US Special Inspector General, in his own words. I won't go into further detail of the story of Iraq since 2003. I felt both responsible and powerless looking at the mess that had been created. It is a tribute to the United States, in the end, that they persevered for long enough to find the right general, General David Petraeus, and the right level of resources in 2007-2008 to bring a higher level of wisdom and security focus to the country to give Iraq a second chance. Last month's municipal elections have shown from the interpretation of results so far that Iraqis have retained their sense of national unity, of secular as well as of religious balance, and of hope. But there is a very long way to go. Personally, I'm apprehensive about the intention of the new American administration under President Obama to withdraw most American forces by the middle of 2010. Iraq is still too insecure, too sectarian, for politics to be able to proceed without violence if outside support is not available. If the American presence has by then run out of shelf life, both in Iraq and in the United States, then the region must take up responsibility for helping Iraq through to the next stage of stabilization. And I hope that Egypt, always conscious of its leadership role in the Middle East, will be able to help bring that concept forward. So what about the lessons? The first is the need for clarity of mission. The American-led coalition failed to identify and plan for the hardest thing they were taking on, the establishment of a new Iraq. They never addressed that fundamental question in any situation of this kind. What do the mass of people really want? They imagined that they were bringing democracy to a new space, and they did not ask that question. Second, legitimacy. Neither in the world's eyes nor in the view of the majority of Iraqis had the coalition established a right to be the masters of Iraq even for a temporary period. In the beginning, Washington had not even calculated that he would be in that position, thinking that Iraqis would take over in an ordered way. In other words, the question of legitimacy was hardly even asked in the capitals that mattered, and if it was asked, the answer was not considered important. Third, security. The post-invasion vacuum was lethal. It is the natural rule for democracy anywhere that the people have to have order before they have choice. Civil law and order, border security, guarding of the huge ammunition dumps, firm local administration, none of these things were thought about or planned for in the early days of the CPA. We've all heard a lot about the early decisions by Ambassador Bremer to disband the army and to keep Baathists out of power. In fact, the army was not disbanded, it had melted away with its weapons into the streets, into the buildings, into the townships, but it was not reconstituted. People did not think about how Baathist members of the Ba'ath Party were. There were so many members of the professional middle classes in Iraq, of people who can run governments in those classes, who were only members of the Ba'ath Party because it was necessary under Saddam Hussein to do that. They were not brought back into government. Free of Saddam, most Iraqis, even from the armed forces, would have followed new directions, a new structure, a new currency, if they'd been asked and paid to do it. This lacuna was a huge one. Next, resources. There is resources in form of troops, there is resources in the form of money. The United States, under the Secretary of Defense and the Pentagon, never believed that they needed several hundred thousand troops. They had been warned about this, for instance, by General Shinseki in 2002, the former chief of the Joint Chiefs of Staff in Washington, but he was ignored, indeed ridiculed. They could have had a larger coalition, perhaps, but other nations didn't want to join. They could have used more Iraqis, but that was not the course they wanted to go. There were not enough troops on the ground to ensure security, hence the surge in 2007, 4 years on. As for funding, Washington never imagined the cost in dollars, let alone the cost in lives. Ambassador Paul Bremer, courageous and determined, even if often misguided, had to fight personally for the nearly $19 billion which Congress assigned to Iraq in late September 2003. By the time he left in June 2004, hardly any of it had been allocated in cash to the theater. Even now, in 2009, with many hundreds of millions of dollars expended, and with the Iraqi oil sector earning until recently much larger sums, few services have been properly restored in Iraq, too few jobs created for Iraqis. Again, the enormity of the task was never fully understood. Then there is political leadership. We're beginning to see signs of it in Iraq 5 years on, but a credible political leader or collection of leaders to take over from the coalition within its natural shelf life, and the natural shelf life for an occupying force of this kind is not really more than a year, was never successfully identified. You can see the same problem emerging in Afghanistan. How can an occupation have an end unless there is a firm political hand to take over, unless there is a strong enough center to keep the whole together? All this illustrates a further lesson, the limits of military power. Countries can be invaded, armies can be defeated, but it is the people who matter. They have to be persuaded to reconstruct their lives, not left in submission or destitution. We're learning in this part globalized, part polarized world that persuasion, political and moral leadership, is much more powerful than the gun or the police baton. Finally, let me point to something I will call unity of command. What I'm saying about what did not happen in Iraq is the linking together of all the different parts of Reconstruction, which has to be done in circumstances as difficult as that, under a unified command. That did not happen in Iraq. As the Inspector General says, as the Iraq reconstruction experience demonstrates, the US government was neither prepared for nor able to respond to the ever-changing demands of the contingency relief and reconstruction mission it faced in Iraq. As Secretary of Defense Robert Gates has observed, in recent years the lines separating war, peace, diplomacy and development have become more blurred and no longer fit the neat organizational charts of the 20th century. The inevitability of future contingency relief and reconstruction operations after or during conflict, disaster or political chaos demands that the American government develop new ways of preparing for and managing the projection of civil military power. That lesson is not just for the United States. It's for the UN, it's for other countries that involve themselves in missions to protect or to relieve disaster. It's a lesson well worth learning that comes out of Iraq. Could the United Nations have helped? They did, of course, in the year of the CPA under Lakhdar Brahimi, when he oversaw the establishment of a new Iraqi administration. They could have done much more if the 19th of August had never happened. But perhaps the United Nations too, that is the Secretariat and the agencies, need to draw some lessons. In this bitter world, there is sometimes a need for toughness and sacrifice. The UN has to be attached to hard power when soft power alone is not enough. If we now have a Washington under President Obama, which is beginning to understand that hard power alone will not do, the rest of us, in Europe, in the Middle East, at the United Nations, may have to meet them from the other direction. Soft power alone is too exploitable. This student audience in particular, and given the inauguration we've had this afternoon, is interested in the United Nations. I could digress for a long time about what the UN is, what it can do, and what it can't do. But remember certain fundamental things about the UN. First of all, it is a collection of member states. It is its member states in its political persona. It is not a separate source of political or military power. It's a forum. But in that sense, it has a real relevance, even as power redistributes itself around the world as new economies begin to emerge with a much greater strength from the freedom that the United States above all, but that the Western world has helped to generate across the globe. But global is only one trend of modern thinking. The local, even the individual, is just as important. That's why I talked about a part globalized and a part polarized world. The regions are important, of a continent or of a nation, its subregions, its communities, its civil society. The world is so complex now, so mixed between global, national, regional, local and individual action, Remember that idea about the unity of command. These things have to be brought together. The UN can be useful in that respect. Kofi Annan in particular, as Secretary General, reached out beyond governments to the private sector, to companies, to parliaments, to religions, to individuals. He understood the need to connect those things. We haven't understood it all in the way that we make our political dispositions and we connect in terms of the projection of power. The UN is, as Strobe Talbot has called it, the great experiment. In each new era, the capacity of the human race to organize itself collectively and globally goes up one notch, even if there's a war in between from the last attempt, from the Congress of Vienna to the League of Nations to the 1945 UN. This is the 21st century, and we will connect at a higher level of globality. But it needs an awful lot of work and an awful lot of understanding, and there are many gaps still to fill. The fact is, as we are learning in this period of economic as well as political crisis, that globalization is only partial. It provokes reactionary forces. The nation-state remains the core political structure, and in times of adversity, nationalism or narrower identities exert their pull. The progress that's been made in advancing individual rights is impressive, and it's necessary. Mary Robinson described it to you 14 months ago. But the links between individual rights, communities, nations, and global interests, between rights and power, are still too weak. Iraq illustrates the downside when the absence of a connecting structure is ignored. Can these lessons be applied to crises in the future of such intensity? I sometimes wonder if lessons are ever learnt by anyone other than academics and theorists. What was the legacy, for instance, of Vietnam in this respect? Or of Britain's post-World War I experience in Iraq? In the eye of today's decision maker, the circumstances today always seem to be new, and the lessons of history at that moment irrelevant. Are we prepared yet in Afghanistan to put the people first, or to understand the limited shelf life of a foreign presence? Will the decision makers who matter understand that violence is not the answer in or for Iran, even if a combination of severe sanctions and dignified incentives for that country may have to be considered? Above all, perhaps, for this region, a future still has to be shaped out of the violence in Palestine. In my view, the recent attack on Gaza has achieved nothing for the longer term, even for Israel's security. What may now become the conditions of a ceasefire that the political leadership, Hamas, and the other extremists in Gaza stop shelling Israeli towns, that the smuggling of arms into Gaza ceases, and that the border crossings are opened so that Gaza is no longer a prison? What may become the ceasefire arrangements now, after those 3 weeks of violence, was available before the violence started without the need for bombing Gaza? Killing 100 Palestinians for each one Israeli, and most of those were civilians, does nothing for Israel and does nothing for peace. So the lessons are the same. The need for justice, legitimacy, the interests of the people, the limits of military power. Hamas and the militants have to learn this too. Palestine needs one voice for the majority. Wise leadership, a move away from violence. Its neighbours must, in my view, show a deeper sense of sympathy and support for ordinary people and what they need. Because long-term stability comes from the satisfaction of a people's needs, not a government's. Both Fatah and Hamas have to learn this, just as Iraq may be starting now to understand it. Can the West and the Middle East work better together on the current challenges than they did over Iraq, or on the first 6 decades of the Palestine disaster? I can't see any certainty that they will. There's history. There are memories. There's distrust. But a new president has arrived in Washington with a different kind of understanding of the non-American world and placing an unusual and a refreshing emphasis on diplomacy ahead of the threat or the use of military force. There appears to be a growing understanding in Washington, though it is not yet complete, of the need for a Palestine interlocutor for peace who represents at least a majority of the Palestinian people and who's capable of channeling the people's anger at injustice into constructive rather than militant channels. The conflict over Israel and Palestine has been unresolvable so far precisely because too little account has been taken of the fundamental requirement that a majority of both the Israeli and the Palestinian peoples must be convinced that a two-state solution is the only answer and is in their long-term interests. That is not yet the case, and continued violence makes it less likely that it will be. So what can the US, and I hope with the backing of the European Union, now inject into the peace process? First of all, there is the need for an intensity of effort that was not visible in the George W. Bush years, and I welcome the appointment of such a senior and wise, experienced envoy as Senator George Mitchell. Second, there must be a recognition that it is ordinary people who matter and who own the path to a solution more than the people in power at any one time. And third, and this needs a good deal of further work, there has to be an environment within the region as a whole, that is conducive to a lasting settlement. In Washington earlier this month, I was arguing strongly for a comprehensive American approach to Middle East stability and economic regeneration, comprising elements that go well beyond an attempt to find a solution to the Palestine question. It should engage the responsibility of all the governments in the region, work out how countries can live together as good neighbours, whatever their history and creed, and establish diplomatic machinery, perhaps even a classic regional conference, that takes account of the interlinking factors affecting not just Palestine, Lebanon, Syria, but also the next steps in Iraq, the future of Iran in its neighbourhood, and the importance of the Middle East for a whole range of external actors on every continent. This may be a tall order, but American diplomacy, if allowed to gather its full strength, is capable of forging a lead on such a requirement. And I know that senior minds in Washington are beginning to think about it. So, in remembering Nadia and Sergio and Jean-Selim Canaan and Fiona Watson and the many others who died on the 19th of August 2003. We can be certain that their example of the selfless pursuit of peace does matter. We are reminded of the fundamental truth that narrow and violent pursuit of power is ephemeral, that collective effort under a system of global legitimacy can be more powerful and more effective than national interest, and that the human qualities for what the United Nations stands and which the Universal Declaration of Human Rights underpins are much more long-lasting. Iraq illustrates the cost of ignoring that truth, and Palestine will do so again unless both Western and Middle East governments construct a new approach. This time, let us learn the lessons. Thank you.